Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. Back in 2007, we started a program that was called the Blue Dot Report. It was 4 minutes long and featured interviews with leading scientists. At the same time, a sister show called In a North State Garden began at this same station, North State Public Radio, based in Chico, California. Its host, Jennifer Jewell, became not only a co-content creator, but also a good friend. We have both followed the same path, expanding our show's first to half-hour programs and then to hour-long shows. Blue Dot and Jennifer's show, Cultivating Place, may have different topics and styles, but they have one thing in common: a passion for our interview subjects and bringing that alive for you, the audience. So when I heard that Jennifer had written a new book, I knew we had to have her on Blue Dot. Jennifer's new book, The Earth in Her Hands, profiles 75 women who share her passion for the art and science of gardening in harmony with nature. Even though gardening's not my hobby, I always enjoy listening to her show and have made many changes in the way we manage our own yard based on things I've learned from her, like avoiding pesticides and fertilizers based on short-term gains rather than the long-term health of not only our garden and yard, but also the health and welfare of the many species of birds, insects, reptiles, amphibians, and microorganisms that share our little plot of this blue dot. If you're listening to Blue Dot as a podcast, I highly recommend that you check out Cultivating Place and its incomparable host, Jennifer Jewell. She joins us now from the NSPR studios in Chico, California. Jennifer Jewell, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, I want to talk to you about your book, The Earth in Her Hands, in a little bit. But before we go there, for listeners to this show in other areas who aren't familiar with you, I want to know a little bit about you first. You love gardening and the tilling of the soil and growing green things. I'd like to know, when did that start for you and how did that happen?
Wow. I'm 54, Dave. I think it's been 54 years. And based on several interviews I've had recently, it probably started before that because I, of course, was inside my mother as an egg all through her life. And so somewhere, somehow, this, whether it's a gene, I don't know, but this cellular impulse to be with green things and in the dirt as much as I can started really early. One of my earliest memories, and it's one of my best memories, is the smell of soil underneath a potting table in a greenhouse in winter in northern Colorado. And I don't know if listeners will have had this experience of going into a greenhouse in the winter, no matter where you live, but it's this warm, little bit moist and earthy scent. And I can't walk into a greenhouse as an adult and not be taken right back to being a very little person. I must have been 3, 2, something like this.
That must have imprinted on you, you know, when you were, you know, gosh, maybe even in the womb.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about it that way.
Yeah.
So your mom was a gardener.
Yes.
How about your grandma?
Well, interestingly, neither of my grandmothers were gardeners, but both of my grandfathers were. And I've always found that fascinating. My mother was a professional florist, garden designer. And when I was little and my sisters were little, she worked in a nursery. Both of my grandfathers, my paternal grandfather worked in the insurance business back east, and he, in his spare time, would grow gladiolas and asparagus, nasturtiums in the summer. He grew the most beautiful nasturtiums at their summer house in Rhode Island. And he just always loved flowers. I remember him being much older close to his last years and in bed a lot of the time with illness. And he would send me outside with his Polaroid camera to ask me to take pictures of the flowering trees in bloom outside in Concord, Massachusetts. And then I'd bring him the Polaroid back up so that he could enjoy looking at his trees.
Oh, well.
I know. Yeah,
that's a beautiful story.
And my maternal grandfather, who was a horse person who had retired to South Carolina, he came from England to work with polo ponies and horses on the East Coast during World War II. He loved roses and camellias in his retirement in South Carolina and had a wonderful collection of both of them.
Wow. And so then throughout your life, you've been a gardener. When did you start to turn it into something you wanted to communicate to others through, you know, whether it be blogging or, you know, whatever? When did that urge for you to communicate your love and passion for gardening and cultivation, when did that start to kick in?
I would say that really, really started to manifest itself in my life when I was a first-time mother. My oldest daughter was, I think I was pregnant with her actually, and I was working at Microsoft's Encarta Encyclopedia in Seattle, and I worked on arts and literature articles for the encyclopedia. I was an editor. Sometimes I would write some of the entries for the online. It was an early version of an online encyclopedia. And I started to suggest to the editor above me articles on famous gardens of the world. And then I realized how much I loved writing about gardens. And in Seattle at that same time was the first occurrence in my life of actually having a little house with a garden that I could play in. So I would work all day at Microsoft and come home and just obsess about my garden. And it was a great climate to be gardening in. So the two started to really come together right then. And so I started to pitch some articles to like a local mindfulness, simplicity living newspaper that was in my neighborhood of Seattle, neighborhood called Ballard. There was a wonderful local newspaper called the Finney Ridge Review. And I would write articles for them on public gardens in the area. And then my former husband and I went to England with our first daughter being just a few months old for his work. And it was there when I didn't have working papers, I had a young child. I then also was pregnant and delivered my second child in England. And I just spent all my time sort of taking care of little people and dragging them to gardens with me. And I started to pitch articles to bigger magazines for pay. And I had my first piece published in Gardens Illustrated in 2001 when we got back to the U.S. And it was from that point on that I knew this was what I wanted to do with my work and life was, you know, kind of explore gardening and talk about it and share about it and learn more about gardening and gardeners.
And then, of course, you have this radio podcast, radio program and podcast, Cultivating Place. And I remember when that first started, it was about the same time as I got started, and it had a different name in a North State garden. Take us back to then. When did you become an audio personality when it comes to gardening?
Well, when my family and I moved here to Northern California, again, for my former husband's work, it was a great opportunity. So this would have been 2007. So I had been writing about gardens for glossy magazines for about 7 years. And I loved writing about gardens. I loved going to visit them. I loved taking photographs of them. But the constraints of the glossy magazine format at that time started to feel really frustrating to me. There was a distinct concern about the aesthetics of every garden, that it had a visual side that could translate to consumers on a page. And what I became really clear about over those first 7 years was that that was not actually the heart of gardening, that it was the stories people shared and the experiences they shared and the sort of sensuality of what it is to be in relationship with these plants on the land where we make our lives. And sometimes that's not pretty, right? Sometimes that's chicken shit and it's compost and it's, dirty hands and calloused hands. And not every garden meets this aesthetic level. But that was the primary way that people were writing and talking about gardening at the time. And so when I'd always been a public radio listener, and when we moved to Northern California, the universe gave me one of those little taps on the shoulder that you get in life sometimes. And I heard an announcement that my local public radio station, North State Public Radio, was looking for PSA writers, volunteer PSA writers. And I thought, I'm in a new place. I have two kids. I'm home all the time with them. I love to garden. I would love to have a gardening program, and the radio would be a fantastic medium to talk about gardening the way I want to talk about it. So I came into the station and I said, I am a writer. I'd be happy to work on PSAs for you, but my ultimate goal is that I want you to have a garden program with me. And many listeners of North State Public Radio will remember Joe O and his fabulous radio voice and his very distinct personality. And he was like, all right, okay, well, forget the PSAs. Let's do the radio program. Do you really think you have enough material for like a year? And I said, yeah, I'm good. I've got you covered. And so he took a chance, and we developed that first 4-minute radio program, which went from 2008 to 2016 when we launched Cultivating Place as the kind of bigger, longer format model of what In a North State Garden had been.
Let's talk about your book, because that's a big deal, writing a book. When did you decide to write your own book?
Well, it's interesting because I didn't actually make that decision. I did ultimately, but the publishers came to me, Timber Press, who is one of the big horticultural publishers in our country, based up in Oregon. They're an imprint of Workman Publishing, which has several different publishing imprints across the country. Timber Press came to me in the fall of 2017. So I'd been doing the Cultivating Place version of my radio program for 2 years. And I got an email out of the blue late in the year, sort of December, saying, would you be interested in writing a book about the current state of women in horticulture? And I opened the email and I said, wow. Yes, as long as it gets to be the way I want to write about these things. And they approached me because they had definitely heard the podcast. I had interviewed lots of people who had written books that were published by Timber Press, and they liked the feel and interview style that I had. And I think they liked the philosophical approach that I took to it. And so they were very happy for me to kind of take the concept and make it my own. So I basically spent all of 2018 writing the book in addition to producing Cultivating Place.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our visit with Jennifer Jewell, the host of NPR podcast and PRX distributed Cultivating Place, is the author of the new book, The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's continue now in our conversation with gardener, writer, photographer, broadcaster, and my good friend, Jennifer Jewell. The book is called The Earth in Her Hands, and you have 75 profiles of these extraordinary women who are cultivating their places. How did you decide, you know, which 75 to do? That would seem to be really a difficult and daunting challenge.
It was really hard. And what I like to say to people now when I'm talking about the book is that this is not the only 75 women. This is a selection of 75 wonderful women at work in this world, in these things. And I, without fail, will be in any room and there could be a woman there that should be in the book, right? That I will meet people and they will say, oh, God, Jennifer, I cannot believe you didn't include this one. And Sure. And I will have to say, you're right. But I then take that as an opportunity and an invitation to all of us to say to ourselves, who are the people in our world doing great things? And how can we lift up their voices and amplify their work as examples and models of leadership and action that is possible for all of us? So it's a starting point. How I chose the 75 that ended up in the book was I started to do kind of a dissection of the categories of fields in horticulture that I thought were important to represent. So I couldn't even get all of those categories represented. I had to keep kind of parsing down and down. But, you know, ultimately there were a handful of categories like environmental science and ecology, plant science, floristry, landscape architecture and garden design, garden writers, garden photographers, herbalists and people in the healing part of the plant world, women in public garden administration and public policy, and botanists would fall under environmental science. So there might be a few other categories, but those were some of the big headers. And then once I identified those categories, I then started filling in names. And one of the things that became clear was I had to kind of define my terms in terms of location, in terms of age and when were these women working? Are they, old? Are they new? Are they dead? Are they? So we ultimately narrowed it down between the publisher and myself to women who were alive and actively at work in these fields today, and whose work had really come to the fore in the last 25 years. So right around the turn of the century and then all of the 2000s so far. And the reason that I did that was that there are so many interesting women in these fields from before. But what they asked me to look at was, what is the current state? And so many of these women's work will have built off the work of, you know, the women who came before them. And then I just started to try and make sure that I was reaching a variety of perspectives, of cultural backgrounds, of approaches to this work, and filling in names and sending out invitations and seeing who was available to participate. Because I did invite women to participate, and in return, I expected a certain amount of time and effort and thought on their part. And that eliminated a handful of people. So that is how I ultimately narrowed down to these women. And the one, I think, critically important factor for me was I needed to look at their work and I needed to say they have moved the needle in some way that is important to me. And they needed to have expanded the field or the possibility for people going forward. So when I would look at a handful of, say, you know, 15 women at work in garden writing or garden photography or landscape architecture, I would say, who are the ones that changed the way we think about this? And that was kind of the kicker for me.
And I'd like to ask you about the format of the book, because I really like it. You can literally just, you know, open to any page and there's a profile of somebody interesting. You can randomly, you can go through the whole book from beginning to end, or you can just, you know, hey, who do I want to find out about today and what's their story? Mm-hmm. And I like that. The other thing I liked is at the end of the profile, you have other inspiring women that kind of, you know, fit into the theme of that person. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. The starting from that last part of your question, that was really important to me. So I sent, as part of the interview process, once a woman committed to being part of this project with me, I sent them all a written set of questions. They all got the exact same set of questions. And I asked them to respond to me in writing. So this was something of a time commitment. And many of these women are very, very busy. But they all agreed to do this. The last two questions that I asked them were, can you name two women who came before you whose work you see as having inspired or been foundational to your work? And the second question was, can you name two women whose work in this world, whether it's directly related to your work or some other part of the horticultural field, whose work is coming up that you think the world should know more about? And in this way, I allowed for this just really wonderful web of interconnection for them to be able to acknowledge the legacies they were building off of and also kind of hold open the door for the other women who were coming up behind them. And in some cases, they were older women whose work had just really started to take off. And in some cases, they were much younger women. In some cases, they were really well-known women. And in some cases, they were, you know, their mothers and aunts and grandmothers who really set the stage for these women to be successful.
Oh, and I noticed also even Sacagawea is in there.
Yeah. That was one of my favorite answers. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I've noticed listening to your program over the years is a theme that comes across to me is how often it is that it is the mother and the grandmother and the, you know, the child spending time with grandma or mom in the garden that gets this lifelong love of gardening going. Is that something, you know, that seems to be kind of universal you've noticed?
There definitely is a strong correlation. It is not the only connection, but it is a strong correlation between children who have been included and invited to be part of the work and relationship of being outside in a garden with plants that allows them to be open to this as an important value in their life going forward. And I would say that it is often a woman-to-woman connection because I think, you know, I am not a sociologist, so I am not giving you a scientifically, statistically significant piece of data here. This would be an observational curiosity of my own. But I would say that by and large, that goes woman to woman because of traditional roles in most societies between women and food and cooking and women and healing and herbs in the garden and women and caretaking children as being primary roles that they take on in many, many cultures. So I think it's a really strong correlation over time and space and different backgrounds. Yeah.
Can I ask you about maybe a couple of profiles that stood out to me?
Yeah.
One of them I really liked was Carol Bornstein. I guess that's how you pronounce it, from the Nature yes. Gardens.
Yeah.
Because I remember going to the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles. And I also remember seeing the Rose Gardens down there by the Coliseum. And that is such an urban setting. I mean, it's literally downtown Los Angeles next to the campus of USC. Can you tell me about her and her work a little bit?
She is fantastic. And I literally will say that about every one of these 75 women, because having spent 2.5 years really immersed in their work and their lives and their stories, I have this like personal affection for all of them and deep admiration for all of them. Carol is one of the women whose work I was very familiar with prior to taking this project on. So I would say, you know, when I was compiling my first list, there were a healthy handful of the women I had interviewed before for my program, whether it be in a North State Garden or Cultivating Place, and who immediately came to mind when I was making my original list. And Carol is one of those. She is a plants woman. She was the horticultural director for the Santa Barbara Botanic Garden for many, many years. And during that time, she developed display gardens that visitors throughout all of those years would learn from, learn in, and be inspired by. And she identified and collected and propagated many native plants that then went into the horticultural trade in order to support gardeners in using more natives in their landscapes, whether they be corporate landscapes or home landscapes. She moved from being at the Santa Barbara Botanic Garden over to being the director of the Nature Gardens at the Natural History Museum of LA a handful of years ago now, maybe 5 years ago. And that garden is just a tremendous asset to the belief in and demonstration of how valuable an urban green space can be for reintroducing native plants to the space and re-attracting the native wildlife that had been there and then weren't there and now are there again. The importance of our urban landscapes in helping to undo some of the fragmentation of space for our wildlife is just not to be underestimated. And Carol Bornstein's work and this garden at the Natural History Museum of LA is collecting all kinds of data on how supportive this space can be, not only to wildlife, but also to humans who live in that urban environment. And the ability of a garden like that to introduce urban dwellers who may not feel like they want to go out into the wild or they can even get out into the wild, it gives them a place to go and meet this nature. And then it kind of familiarizes those people with that kind of nature so that they are more comfortable when they do go out into nature outside those city limits and they feel more at home there. And once that happens, then of course, all kinds of better relationship and understanding and caretaking becomes possible.
Yeah, and that seems to be one of your major themes in your program is how we can, you know, landscape and use native plants to attract, you know, natural pollinators to our yard and, you know, garden in more harmony with nature. So that one appealed to me. Let me ask you about another one. As a science person, I found this really interesting. It was Elaine Ingham, I think it is.
Yeah.
The soil food web. And you know, because really, you know, for everybody who grows anything, it really all starts with the soil and the understanding of what's going on in that living dirt is the most important component to gardening to me, you know, as I learn more about it. Could you tell us a bit about her?
So Dr. Elaine Ingham is a soil scientist, a microbiologist, and an ecologist, and she is the founder of something called the Soil Food Web, Inc. And she is a foundational woman to a lot of the work that we now take for granted. When you hear that term, soil food web, which was a term she and her lab coined back in the late, I believe, 1980s, when she was beginning her research work at the University of Colorado, Colorado State University, Fort Collins. And at that time, a lot of soil science was being done in sort of agricultural departments at some of our big universities, especially the land-grant universities. And we were very much still in the wake of what is known as the Green Revolution. So this idea that was really perpetuated from the world wars up until the 80s, 90s, that soil was basically inert and that we needed to add things to it like your NPK, which most gardeners will understand the meaning of, your nitrogen, your phosphorus, your
potassium.
Mm-hmm. And that that in doing those additions and feeding your plants, you were taking care of the cycle. You know, otherwise, soil was just kind of a container. Her husband was a microbiologist working in a different part of the university. And between hearing what was happening with his work and seeing what was happening with her work, she kept sort of really questioning this concept that the things that she could see were alive in the soil had no real purpose. And it was her research that started to really delve into and articulate and highlight how some of these things were working together for really impressive results. And one of the questions that kept coming to her mind in these early years of her research was, well, if that's true, that soil is inert and these things are basically just there, explain an old growth forest to me. Like, that just doesn't make sense to me. So she pushed through. And so now I think we as gardeners in 2020 say, well, of course the mycorrhizae are important. Of course the fungal connections are, you know, critically important and beneficial to everything at work with these plants. But at this time, that was not accepted belief in the science. And now it is.
Yeah, you might as well, you know, take some crushed rock from the moon and throw chemicals and water in it and call it soil, but it's not. It's
right.
Not the living layer of soil that we have on Earth, which is such a really fragile thing and not very deep. It's like the more I learn about, you know, soil, the more fascinated I become by it. Another thing that stands out in your work on your radio program and in the book is this idea of how gardening is this middle class white people's thing to do, and it has been. But, you know, kind of pushing back against that, you even mentioned, I think, in your introduction something about decolonializing the garden. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. It's sort of interesting that you ask these two questions right next to each other, because I think both of them speak to a mindset and a frame of reference that thankfully are relatively short in time. Like, when you think about the history of humans and interaction with plants, this is a very, very blip of an episode of time in which somehow, in this information age that we've been in since, again, like the world wars, because of the way leisure activity was developed in industrialized nations, because of the way, you know, propaganda material, newspapers, magazines kind of served that leisure class, there came to be this bizarre representation of gardening as this sort of sweet hobby, like very nice but not very necessary, and mostly the purview of middle class and wealthy white people on the weekends. And thankfully, we have thousands of years of cultural engagement between humans and plants that belie that weird representation that became dominant these last 75, maybe 100 years. So hopefully we're past that, because it was a construct that is not to the service of anybody. And I didn't really realize that this was something that was happening in my program. But the minute I didn't have to worry about aesthetics and I could talk to anybody about anything, and I wasn't working with like pitching an article to a magazine and having them accept it or not accept it, I could talk to whoever I wanted. And one of the first people that made me say, ah, this is a good one, I really want to have this episode, was actually being at a pledge drive at North State Public Radio and being one of the pledge drive hosts in the booth with our previous jazz host, Daniel. And Daniel's work was fabulous as a jazz host. I had no idea he was a gardener. So when he and I were, you know, in our off time on air, he would say, oh my gosh, you know, I really want to share with you these beans that I got from my great aunt when my mother and I went to like clean out her house in the South. And we found all these baby jars of these dried beans. And he was fascinated as an African-American man. He was fascinated about these seeds of the African diaspora and the food ways of his people from South Carolina and the Low Country. And I was like, this is so cool. And so we had a great episode. And then not long after that, I was reading, I forget which some publication, and I came across the work of Dr. Elizabeth Hoover, who is a professor of American Studies at Brown University and also an indigenous woman who was documenting all of the growing and gardening and seed work of indigenous communities across the country. Her book on the topic is going to be published this year, 2020, I think. Maybe it's 2021. But it was this fantastic sort of – it started as a documentary project where every weekend or every summer off from Brown, she would go out on the road and she would go and find these indigenous community projects and programs and heirloom seed banks, and she would interview them and create this – kind of like garden seed bank of stories. And I was just fascinated by this. And so slowly it became much more apparent to me that these were stories that were really missing from our mainstream understanding of what gardening is and what gardeners look like and why it's important. And I didn't really realize it as my own blind spot until I started to unravel it a little bit. And it's an important thing to me that I don't speak for these people, but that I give them a place to speak about what they're doing.
Yeah, but you can speak with them.
And yeah, exactly.
That's what's wonderful.
Yeah.
Let's take a short break. If you're just joining us, we are talking to the host of Public Radio's Cultivating Place, Jennifer Jewell. Jewell has a new book out titled The Earth in Her Hands. It profiles a diverse array of women around the world that have a passion for plants and the living soils they grow in. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's return now to our visit with my dear friend and fellow broadcaster-podcaster, Jennifer Jewell. She's the host of Cultivating Place, produced here in Northern California on North State Public Radio, and she's the author of the new book, The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. Well, one of the wonderful things about your book is it is a spectrum, and one of my favorite stories was Lady Arabella Lennox Boyd, if for no other reason because I love saying that name.
Yeah,
and it makes it sound like some stuffy. Oh, it's Lady Arabella Lennox Boyd and her prize roses, but that's not at all what she's all about. You know, and the notion of the English garden is to me it's such an archetype. I mean, even the Beatles. Mm. Had a wonderful song, I Am the Walrus. Sitting in an English garden, waiting for the sun. Tell me about her, because I just loved her story.
Well, she is a fascinating woman, and her reach into the wider horticultural world was what really sparked my imagination. And there are many notable and very good female landscape architects and garden designers in England and in the UK at large. So she is the founder and principal of Arabella Lennox Boyd Landscape and Architectural Design in London. And she has been at this work for many, many years. She was born in Italy and came to England, and so brought two different kind of landscape design eyes and traditions to her work. For me, one of the things that really struck me about her work was her winning of the Best in Show Garden pretty early in the awarding of this at the Chelsea Flower Show in England, which is one of the big shows that kind of highlight new trends or new plants or new design ethos in our world. And not a lot – when you look at the statistics of how long the show has been going and how many men versus women have presented their designs and how many men versus women have been awarded this, she was an early female star. That is of note. Then you put on top of that the fact that she went on to be a trustee at the Kew Botanic Garden in England and really help to guide some of the leading kind of principles and ethics behind plant collections, between plant knowledge in a country that then passes that as a kind of voice of authority to the rest of the world. That is some pretty important influence.
Yeah, she's just her whole story was amazing to me, as all of them are. That's and we'll leave the rest for the readers to read the book, because every page has a wonderful story like that. I'd like to ask you a couple of tough questions now. One is, where do you think that gardens fit into the environmental stress that our planet is undergoing? How can our pieces of land, whether it be just your backyard or whatever you can do on your little patch of earth, where do they fit in with, you know, combating what's going on with the planetary stress right now?
Well, anyone who's heard my program, and you certainly know that I think one of the big drivers for me in moving out of my garden and into a radio program is to empower gardeners to understand just how valuable and powerful they are as agents of potentially beneficial change. I think that, again, in light of the last 70 years in mostly industrialized countries, gardeners have sometimes played a detrimental role in this world, in terms of chemical inputs, in terms of poor resource use, in terms of not thinking about the value of their spaces to the broader ecosystem or wildlife needs. But they also are a key player in making a difference in the other direction, in being those spaces where soil is tended and watersheds and water tables are allowed to do what they're supposed to do and clean our water and store our water for us. They are absolutely critically important in suburban and urban areas to undoing some of this habitat fragmentation and degradation that we've seen across our globe. You know, I feel often in what I do that there is a chance that I am speaking to the converted, and that we are all saying the same thing, you know. Don't use chemicals. Be organic. Add wild plants. Let some of the weeds go. You know, let it be a little messy, a little wild. Yet I still look down my basically suburban street, and there are only two gardens that, you know, here in Northern California, where we only get 19 inches of rain and, 4 months without it in the summer. There's only one other garden on my street that doesn't have a green lawn out front. And that makes no sense to me. And that encourages me to know that there is plenty of room for improvement, because gardeners can play a really important role as both modeling what can be done and how beautiful it is, and educating others and being bright spots for the bees and the butterflies and the hummingbirds and the worms and the mycorrhizae and the moon and the stars and the water.
Well, that's inspiring. And before I let you go, I'm going to ask you a really impossible question, because I want it to be a fairly succinct answer, because we're about out of time. But, you know, when you ask somebody, well, what did you do this weekend? Oh, I worked in my garden. And people have a picture in their head of what that looks like. But, you know, one of the things I've learned from you over the years is that the term garden is just so multifaceted. So I want to ask you a really difficult to answer question. What is a garden to you?
A garden is a mental construct that holds the importance of our human relationship to the green living world.
And one last thing. Have you ever read J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings?
I have.
Are you familiar with the Ents?
Remind me.
The Ents are these, like, Treebeard is this tree creature, and they are tree herders. They somehow
manage
the forest. And one of the things I always found that resonated with me was that they were always searching for the Ent wives that they had lost somehow in the distant past. And Tolkien's trilogy is really, it's a mythology for England, where a lot of, you know, these ideas of cultivation come from the ancient past. And it was the Ent wives who were not the ones that herded the forest, the wild trees. They were the ones that tended the orchards, the trees and the plants that bore fruit, that fed. And I always found that to be just a really wonderful allegory to what your mission is of this book, of highlighting how women, you know, through the centuries have cultivated the earth, and men too. But I love the fact that you highlight them, and that the title is that the earth in her hands. How did you come up with the title?
It was a back and forth, but we ultimately settled on this. There was some discussion about earth on her hands, or there were a couple of others. But this really kind of fit for me in terms of both the physicalness of dirt and soil and, the plant rootlets being held in our hands, but also, you know, from a greater level, the whole globe and planetary well-being is in all of our hands.
Well, Jennifer, it's been a joy, as always, to talk to you, and highly encourage our readers to get your book and listen to your program, because if you love to garden and grow things and just have an interest in living green things, it's always a fascinating journey with you on Cultivating Place.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's been such a pleasure. And I always see us as sort of sibling programs with our place in space and the Blue Dot and this green planet.
Yes. And, you know, people ask me all the time, you know, what's your show about? And it's like, it's kind of to distill it down, my show is about just exploration and science and nature. And yours is about how we, you know, to me, when I listen to it, how we can live in harmony with the earth in our backyards, how we can bring nature into our backyards and live with it instead of trying to fight against it as if it's some kind of epic battle to be won.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Jennifer, and I appreciate your patience today with all the technical stuff.
Thank you very much for having me as a guest, Dave. It was fun.
Thanks once again to our guest, Public Radio's extraordinary communicator of all things botanical, Jennifer Jewell. Her new book, The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants, is published by Timber Press and available from most major booksellers. Back when Jennifer and I were just starting out our radio programs, my family lost our beloved German Shepherd, Daisy, and I asked Jennifer what kind of daisies would be appropriate to plant on her grave in our backyard here in Red Bluff. Jennifer told me that Shasta daisies would be a good choice. While the advice was much appreciated, what was amazing was that Jennifer Jewell drove all the way to my home, an hour north of hers, and dropped off some Shasta daisies ready to plant. When I got home from work, there were the loveliest of flowers ready to go into our backyard and a kind note on my front porch. And that tells you everything you need to know about what a kind and remarkable human being Jennifer Jewell is. Blue Dot, just like Jennifer's Cultivating Place, is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this or past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to both of our podcasts on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.